I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. It's Dr. Sam Madeira back here on the Dr. Madeira Show. And today we have a distinguished guest from Australia who has been traveling around with other herbalists, Lee Carroll. How are you doing today, Lee?
I'm great. Thanks, Sam.
Excellent. And we've met a few times over the years with your tours of the U.S. And then we were hanging out in Australia back in July of this year, 2019, which was spectacular to be.
Yeah, that was a fun trip. Yeah,
it really was. So for folks that don't know who Lee Carroll is, you should. And that's why he's on the podcast today. Lee is a medical herbalist in Australia with nearly 30 years of experience in the herbal industry. His herbal medicine career started with MediHerb, which is, in my opinion, the best and highest quality medical herbal company in the world, in 1990 as production manager. And now he spends most of his time educating healthcare professionals on the use and integration of Western herbal therapy. And he is in clinic 2 days a week in his home in Australia. So spectacular. It's really excellent to speak with you today. And we just recently saw each other in Oakland when you were speaking there.
Yeah, that was a great weekend.
It truly was. And one of your passions in herbal medicine is the endocannabinoid system and using botanicals for balancing that system. And today we're going to talk about metabolic syndrome and stress and hormones and whatnot and how herbs can help men and women recover from chronic stress and metabolic syndrome. So are there any particular things that you've been researching that you're really excited about recently or up and coming projects that you want to share?
Well, the most exciting thing, I think, and there's still a long way to go, is the intersection between the endocannabinoid system and the development of metabolic disease in general, and then the flow-on effects that we see in this case, you know, hormonal issues in men, low testosterone, low libido, lack of vitality, maybe, you know, early onset prostatic hyperplasia, for example. So that's been occupying a bit of my time lately, and I'm fully enjoying the discovery process.
Spectacular. So with metabolic syndrome, maybe we should break it down for the listeners. What are some of the key components of the breakdown in physiology that we see, and how can herbs help repair the physiology for specifically men, since we're men?
Yeah, well, let's start a step before that and maybe just list off some of the things that create the disharmony in the body that leads to a dysregulated state. And it's very hard to avoid these things in modern life. So we have a sedentary lifestyle, which creates its own issues. We have lack of exercise, which creates a different set of issues. We're living under too much stress. We eat too much of the wrong food. We don't eat enough of the right stuff, like phytonutrients and fiber, for example, are leading nutrient deficiencies in the US population. And then we have an early life history that we carry with us. that creates an impact. The diet that we have and the stress that we're under creates a dysbiotic gastrointestinal tract, which leads to systemic inflammation, development of insulin resistance in the liver, and a snowballing into a derangement of our physiology where we put our vascular system under stress, we change the quality of our blood, we change the dynamics in our liver, we create chronic inflammation. And insulin resistance is probably a hallmark of the setting of metabolic syndrome. And depending on the patient, depending on their history, depending on, you know, happenstance, or, you know, depending on their luck in terms of trauma and other things, what I've just mentioned can coalesce into what's called metabolic syndrome, which is then a precursor state, really, into the development of a whole range of pathologies. Twice the risk of cardiovascular disease, five times the risk of type 2 diabetes, significantly increased risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Some researchers suggest that non-alcoholic fatty liver disease may in fact be a precursor state. In any case, those two things, I'll say NAFLD if I have to repeat that, so keep on repeating the long names, The reason for that is that it's quite a common underpinning in the pathology. It's comorbid with metabolic syndrome. But high levels of uric acid, we typically refer to that as gout, but there's a lot more people with elevated uric acid than there are people with elevated uric acid and gout. And uric acid creates the development of the diseases that we're talking about. In women, it's polycystic ovarian syndrome. It could be kidney disease. It might be the development of dementia. Cancers are related to it, some autoimmune diseases. The list is incredibly long. And then today's focus is the derangement in male physiology, particularly hormonal physiology, where we have low testosterone, reduced fertility, lowered vitality, perhaps even premature aging.
Yeah, it does seem like it's an epidemic. And one thing that I've seen over and over again, it continues to shock me, is that men, even in their early 30s and early 20s, in some cases, having low testosterone and metabolic syndrome, of course, being an epidemic, and pretty much everybody has metabolic syndrome, almost to the point where it's a surprise when people do not have metabolic syndrome, and then that playing into things like sleep apnea and other issues.
Yes, exactly. I think the numbers are in adults, like 25% of the population. And worryingly, the numbers are increasing in our adolescent population. So we might be seeing men now, you know, in their mid-40s. But in another 10 years, we might be seeing the same thing in men in their mid-30s.
Yeah, that is concerning. It's definitely concerning. And, I mean, male infertility also is at risk, as you mentioned. And, you know, there's been case reports of men who have no sperm count at age 35, which is concerning and shocking. As far as where the breakdown happens in the mechanism, maybe we can articulate what that is for the listener. I mean, what is metabolic syndrome, and how they get it diagnosed? What are the symptoms? And then how does that affect something like testosterone levels?
Sure. The metabolic syndrome is relatively easy to clinically define. And the definitions around metabolic syndrome started off in, you know, I think maybe the 1930s or something, where people were noticing associations with gout and hypertension, you know, with a sort of an opulent lifestyle. So the definition now is made quite simple and easy. You have to have three or more of these following things to fall into the category. So if you're a male, your waist circumference has to be greater than 40 inches. And the waist circumference is important because the fat in our viscera and abdominal fat is morphologically different to the fat in the rest of the compartments in the body, so it behaves differently. So the waist measurement is more important than weight. There needs to be a certain level of dyslipidemia. So, and it's defined by low HDL rather than focusing on LDL. And in men, it has to be less than 40 milligrams per deciliter. Okay. There needs to be a certain amount of hyperglycemia. So fasting blood glucose needs to be over 100 milligrams. And hypertension, systolic blood pressure needs to be...
I'm on a city street in Virginia standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
I'm here in my living room peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Over 130, and diastolic, I think, needs to be greater than 85. And any of those categories, the dyslipidemia, the hyperglycemia, or the hypertension, if patients are taking some pharmaceutical medication for that, then that puts them into that definition. So three or more of those puts you in that metabolic disease category. So metabolic syndrome technically isn't a disease. It's a precursor state. It's an early warning that you've got time to do something about it. And with appropriate, diet and exercise and the appropriate use of herbal therapy, it's a very straightforward thing to treat in a clinical setting, I think.
Right. Yeah, it does seem to respond very well to botanical medicine, as you mentioned, and lifestyle and diet. If people are really willing to do the work, they can prevent diabetes and cardiovascular disease, as you mentioned in the beginning here today.
Yeah. So, perhaps I could talk about some of the things that contribute to the development of metabolic syndrome, beyond the broad topics that I just mentioned. And I think I forgot to put in there the toxic world that we live in. Endocrine disrupting chemicals and heavy metals, and there's a whole gamut. There's like 300,000 chemicals, I think, that are being produced by the global chemical industry, and quite a lot of substances in daily use can interact with our biology to bring about sometimes significant but often very subtle derangements, which when combined with those things that I previously mentioned, take a person down the track. So the probably, it's the chicken and the egg type thing. What comes first? Do you put on weight first, or do you challenge your microcirculation first? And this is a debate that goes on in the literature. And many researchers think that microvascular dysfunction actually is the cause of insulin resistance, which then creates the pre-diabetic diabetic state. So the things that impact on our microcirculation are the excessive consumption of freely available sugars in our foods, for example. So not just the quantum, but also the regularity of the consumption. So when we have high levels of sugar and fat in our bloodstream, it damages the endothelial linings of our vascular system. And if we're to have a proper insulin response, then the insulin gets produced in the beta cells in the pancreas. It gets into circulation, and then it needs to travel through the endothelial cells to get into the surrounding tissue, so muscle tissue, for example, to facilitate the uptake of the glucose. So if we have an environment that damages that endothelial lining, then we create a state where the insulin, which is a very big protein, is less capable of making an entry through those endothelial cells and into the surrounding tissues. And then from the same perspective, being exposed to chemicals in our environment, particularly air pollution in this case, many of those chemicals subtly impact on mitochondrial function. And mitochondria are the little furnaces in all of our cells that produce our energy, and the energy currency in cells is adenosine triphosphate, ATP. And the environmental chemicals can have a negative impact on mitochondrial function. So that means that the endothelial cells don't have the energy that they fully need to have an optimized performance in all of the departments and all of the categories that that those cells are functioning in. So in this case, the transport of insulin and also a remodeling of the vascular system. So when we have poorly functioning endothelial cells, all of the signals that keep the vascular beds healthy start to become remodeled because of the low energy state. And that tends to create a constriction in the vascular system, which can have an impact on the development of cardiovascular disease and probably has an impact on erectile function as well. So, by focusing on improving the diet and getting glycemic control back and dealing with some of the toxic exposure, we can start to make inroads, on what are two of the key causes.
So we have glycemic control, blood sugar control for the listeners, and vascular function, endothelial function in the vascular system systemically, and then a lot of the times kind of the canary in the coal mine, if you will, or the red flag that often is not dealt with for what I've seen clinically for years is erectile dysfunction, and then we're looking at vascular issues there as well as hormonal with insulin resistance and low testosterone for men.
Yeah, so we could actually rephrase that as the canary in the trousers.
Yes. I was waiting for you to say something comical. Yes. Sounds like a good topic, a good title for a book. But yeah, I mean, it definitely is. And the thing that shocked me the most about working with men over the years is that I've heard men say, oh, yeah, I've had erectile dysfunction for over 13 years. Haven't had sex for 2 to 10 years, haven't had erection for at least 5 years, 2 years, 10 years. And this is the first time, sitting across from me or a colleague when I worked in a clinic with other doctors, was the first time that they had looked to do something about it besides Viagra or one of those PDE5 inhibitor medications similar to Viagra, like tadalafil. So obviously that's not working on the root cause, just vasodilating the blood vessels to the penis, although it may be helpful for some. And in some of these cases, that medication wasn't even helping anymore or ever. So
yeah, because it's not dealing with the root cause, is it?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, if we wanted to expand on the theme, too much of the modern food that we eat puts excessive stress, not just on the vascular system, but all of the nutrients have to go into your liver. And excessive nutrient intake, it's a little bit technical, but there's a thing called the hepatorenal reflex. And when you overconsume food, the 80% of the blood that goes into the liver, it comes from the portal vein. And mm-hmm. it's got low oxygen. So when you overeat, you need oxygen to create the energy to bring the nutrients across the absorptive surfaces. And it just lowers the oxygen threshold a little bit in the portal blood. And the liver is very sensitive to the levels of oxygen. And the hepatorenal reflex is a reflex from the liver to the kidney. And when the hepatorenal reflex gets turned on, it sends a signal to the kidney to increase blood pressure, to retain sodium as a part of that strategy, to turn on the sympathetic response. And it's associated with elevated levels of adenosine, which make you feel sleepy during the day. So all of those nutrients coming into the liver, particularly when it's high fructose, the liver can't cope with high levels of fructose, and there's no off switch in the metabolism. So if you have a lot of fructose, almost in the first pass, it all gets processed in your hepatocytes. And if that's combined with high levels of fat, then you're adding to this burden. So fructose consumes all of the ATP energy. There's so much fructose pouring down the metabolic pathways that it overburdens the cells, and it splits off into other pathways that see an increase in methylglyoxal, for example, increases in uric acid, and elevated levels of adenosine as a result of the breakdown of adenosine triphosphate. And this mm-hmm. then creates elevated levels of triglycerides in the hepatocytes, and then that slows, then they start to swell and get bigger. You get a fatty liver. And then that slows down the blood flow in the liver, and that adds to the hepatorenal reflex. The
so
cells
can't... it's a downward spiral from there. It's
a downward spiral from there, yeah. And then all of those extra calories that are being...
I'm here in my living room peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Consumed. They've got to be stored somewhere, because the sedentary lifestyle and the lack of exercise is less than... So the expenditure is less than the consumption. So the fat starts to get stored in visceral adipose. And then cells have got mechanisms to detect their internal stress. So as fat cells start to accumulate their fat, they feel a bit stressed. They're like, gee, I might burst, you know. So they start to send inflammatory signals. So that recruits macrophages. They come into the area, and it'd be like firefighters arriving at the fire, and they say to themselves, oh, like, there's not enough of us to deal with this fire. We need to get more troops, so we've got to send out lots of messages. So those early responders and the macrophages that come in start to become overly activated, and we start to create an inflammatory state. And then we start to have dysregulation in some of the hormonal signals that start to add to that kind of snowballing effect. And then the diet that we're talking about that causes that issue in the liver and the development of increased fat storage also creates dysbiosis. And then in a dysbiotic setting, we start to have leakage of cell wall fragments from gram-negative bacteria. Bacteria can relocate and start living on the inside of the intestine. Food fragments start to come through. And that puts an added burden on the liver, starts to increase the inflammatory setting. The free fatty acids from the stored fat start to go through the portal vein, and that starts to accelerate the buildup of fat in the liver. And then from there, it's kind of all downhill. And we then probably need to look at the hallmarks of, you know, what it actually means to have, you know, these hormonal issues in the male. So low sex hormone binding globulin, for example.
So one thing that comes to mind when you're talking about all this pathology happening in the liver is that in Ayurvedic medicine, the kind of natural medicine of India that's been around for thousands of years, as you know, and the listeners might not know about, they mention that diabetes and prediabetes all occur in the liver. And in Western allopathic medicine, they're very focused on the pancreas, and the mention of the liver is really only maybe taught in a biochemistry class in medical school, but on the clinical end, endocrinologists are looking at, you know, insulin therapies and metformin and things like that. But the focus has been taken away from the liver. How, maybe we can get into at some point today about how we focus on the liver and the pancreas and other body systems and the gut with herbal therapies, and how that's maybe a little bit different than just using metformin or other pharmaceuticals approach for the uninitiated listener into herbal therapies.
Sure. Well, understanding how the system works allows you to create kind of like the targets that you want to achieve. So from a liver point of view, we need to reduce the burden that's, you know, being put on the liver. So we can't just supplement our way out of a problem without the necessary lifestyle changes. So we do have to work on the diet. We do have to work on improving the quality of the exercise. And then from the point of view of herbal liver support, there's a wealth of knowledge around herbs that improve the functioning of the liver. And we all know that if the liver has a natural regenerative capacity, so if we lose some of our liver, it will grow back. So the cells have got this facility for renewal. And the key herb in that class is milk thistle. And milk thistle's been well studied over many, many decades. And the standardized extracts of milk thistle, where we're focusing on compounds called the flavonolignans, they have the ability to restore functionality, not just in the hepatocyte, but decrease the inflammation in the stellate cells and the endothelial cells and the Kupffer cells even, which are the resident macrophages in the liver. So it has an impact on improving the way that the liver functions. And it also has a protective role as well as that restorative role. So it can help prevent damage as well. So milk thistle, you know, ranks quite highly in the overall scheme of things. And interestingly, a group of researchers were looking at the benefits of milk thistle in liver damage in patients that were looking at the benefits of milk thistle in patients that had alcohol-damaged livers, and they noticed that the people with diabetes had their diabetes improved as well. So they went and looked at a group of people with diabetes with milk thistle, and they found that milk thistle had a significant impact on improving insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is technically not just one thing. You can be insulin resistant in different compartments of your body. So if you don't exercise, that naturally brings about a level of insulin resistance in your muscles because your muscles don't need the energy anymore. So that those mechanisms don't get maintained. But there's a separate mechanism in the liver, which is the main processing center for all of our nutrients. So milk thistle is a key thing. If we're looking at the overall function of the liver, we could look at some other herbs like clove artichoke, which has some sort of restorative properties to the liver as well. But its additional benefit is that it improves the quality and the production of bile, and it improves the quality of the bile as it goes down the biliary ducts, and it improves the contractile ability of the gallbladder to deliver the bile when it's required. So those two herbs are my key herbs, you know, when we're focusing on liver health specifically.
Excellent. And the quality of the milk thistle, oftentimes I see milk thistle as a tea. Isn't it best to extract the fat soluble constituents? I know there's multiple constituents that we're looking at, but there's some key ones
you can't do it with tea. And the active part of the milk thistle is the seed coat, which is the dark fibrous protective layer around the oily like seed endosperm.
Okay.
And you need about 14 grams of whole milk thistle seeds two or three times a day, the equivalent of an extract of 14 grams. So 42 grams a day, that's like 1 1/3 ounces of seed. So hot water doesn't extract it very well, so it really needs to be an extract, and it's quite easily available in a tablet form to give you that the dose that you need.
Excellent. And I had a quick question about, you were mentioning earlier about the gut issues that happen with metabolic syndrome and talking about gram-negative bacteria and leaky gut and things like that, or intestinal impermeability would be, I guess, the scientific explanation. But and does that correspond or eventually become small intestinal microbial overgrowth, or what some people are calling SIBO still, in the gut?
Not necessarily. You know, there is a strong correlation, and technically we could call SIBO SIMO, because it's not just bacteria, it's fungi as well. So it's really a microbial overgrowth. And it's a particular disease state where there's more than just dysbiosis going on. There's typically a history of antibiotic use that overlaps with some ileocecal valve dysfunction and some biliary disorders. There's sometimes issues with the motility mechanisms in the small intestine that lead to that. So from the point of view of, you know, the general, you know, male population, a good herb to use that deals with just, you know, a dysregulated ecology in the gut, as well as the SIBO, if it does exist, is a herb or herbs that contain berberine. So in clinic, I use a philodendron amaranth source of berberine, and 200 milligrams of berberine, two or three or even four times a day, has the dual benefit of improving the quality of the bacterial environment. And in human studies, it's been shown to decrease the pathogenic bacteria and actually increase the beneficial bacteria as measured by certain bifido species. And it has the dual benefit. If you take that herb, berberine, with milk thistle, there's a synergy that happens. And the berberine gets into the bloodstream, and it's as effective as metformin, which is a common drug that's used in this category. It works as well as metformin. It's 1 milligram to 1 milligram approximate, you know, like ratio. So they're 1 to 1. And there's you know, relatively few side effects. If any, there's just a bit of gastrointestinal discomfort or even mild constipation in a very small number of patients. So that makes it quite easy to prescribe.
Excellent. And with the berberine for insulin resistance long-term, can people take that for months and months, or do you recommend that they cycle on and off every 2 to 3 months or so?
Well, the clinical studies with berberine in insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome and diabetes, patients take it for a long time and they don't have a break. And it doesn't seem to have a negative impact. I think we all got scared off by some of the early in vitro work that suggested that berberine was selectively antimicrobial, so a little bit would kill off the pathogens, But at a certain dose, it killed off the bifido or lacto organisms as well. But when that in vitro research is kind of, you know, basically replicated in the human, that doesn't appear to be the case. And it seems to be quite safe. Although, that's having great. Said that, it's rare for a patient to be 100% compliant, and breaks naturally occur because people forget or lose motivation or just get sick of taking all their pills. So,
right. Yeah. Very true.
Let me add just another little piece, an interesting piece to the puzzle, because I mentioned the endocannabinoid system in the beginning. This state of metabolic dysfunction is a state where there's too much endocannabinoid system tone. So there's too many CB1 receptors being expressed, for example, in the liver and also in visceral adipose. And in the gastrointestinal tract, the dysbiosis upregulates a precursor enzyme that manufactures one of our main endocannabinoids, a thing called anandamide, which is an arachidonic acid-based ethanolamine. And in the situation of significant danger, so the immunological danger from the bacteria leaking from, or the fragment bacterial fragments leaking into the systemic, interact with danger receptors on immune cells to increase the perception of danger, to increase the perception of a threat. And then that engages the stress response, which can involve cortisol. And then this state where you've got too much endocannabinoid and too many receptors, the CB1 receptors are expressed on mitochondria. And when you have too much endocannabinoid tone in this situation, the signals at the mitochondria are inhibitory and they turn the mitochondria down. So you start to get a lessening of the production of energy in your cells. And the antidote is to reduce CB1 receptors and to increase the activity at CB2 receptors and deal with the the health of the gut to slow down the production of those endocannabinoids. And this combination that we're talking about of berberine and milk thistle, berberine lowers the systemic inflammatory environment. You can measure that with reduced C-reactive protein, even highly sensitive C-reactive protein, and a whole bunch of other inflammatory markers like the precursor to C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, and tumor necrosis factor alpha. Mm-hmm. And so that then starts to reduce the drive to have that endocannabinoid tone. And then CB1 receptors and are down-regulated, and CB2 receptors are up-regulated in animal models of milk thistle. So the dual benefit of milk thistle and berberine, the outcomes aren't different, but the one of the ways that we understand how they work has had a spotlight shined on it with this understanding of the endocannabinoid system. And there's a number of things in our diet that we can do to reduce action at CB1 receptors. Carrot juice, fresh carrot juice in moderate quantities has got a phytochemical called falcarinol, which is active at blocking that receptor. Mm-hmm. And then herbs like or phytochemicals like beta-caryophyllene are quite active at the CB2 receptor. Herbs like Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea purpurea are quite active at that CB2 receptor. So we can think about new ways of tackling the condition from that point of view. And herbs like green tea and Korean ginseng have been shown to improve mitochondrial function. Korean ginseng's got a fabulous clinical record for improving vitality, and there's a study in men where they looked at mitochondrial copy numbers in our mitochondria. Because it's such an aggressive chemical place, basically it's a furnace, there's lots of copies of our of the mitochondrial DNA. The mitochondria have got their own DNA. So the more copies you have, as one gets burned up by the stress, you know, another one will take its place. So the more copies you have, the healthier your mitochondria are and the more capable they are of, you know, regenerating themselves. And just 4 weeks on Korean ginseng increased the mitochondrial copy number by 5 times compared to men that didn't take the Korean ginseng at a dose.
What dose was the study?
It was, 3 grams a day, which is, you know, reasonably high, but it's quite achievable, you know, with some of the modern good quality herbal products that are available.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, Korean ginseng, I think a lot of people are reaching for other things that are a lot more harmful. What I see is a lot of energy drinks, caffeine. I mean, you were talking about the adenosine making men tired and then the hypertension, and they drink more Rockstar energy drinks or 5-hour energy, and then they have, you know, 2 16-ounce coffees every day.
Yeah, we're just victims of, you know, the company's marketing campaigns that just lead us down this road of false hope.
So true.
Let me mention a couple of other herbs for metabolic syndrome, because I don't want to give the impression that just milk thistle and berberine are all you need to use. When you look at the clinical research and kind of bring it together in a rational kind of way, and part of the challenge with modern herbal therapy is there's so many choices. You know, how do you arrive at a sensible kind of consensus on what's best to use? So in my experience, the combination of bitter melon and Nigella sativa, or the black cumin seed, and cinnamon. You could probably add fenugreek in there as well for its 4-hydroxyisoleucine, although that's kind of less important in metabolic syndrome, more important in diabetes. Those three herbs, when you combine them together, you can hit many of the targets, the biological targets that become dysregulated in metabolic syndrome. And the rationale for why herbs work, the rationale for natural medicine, is that everything on the planet has the same sort of, you know, blueprint. You know, we all come from the same form of chemistry. And the molecules that plants make, when we select out the medicinal plants and we look at their chemistry, there's a significant ability for the chemistry in those plants to have beneficial interactions with many of the proteins in our body that need to be maintained so that they can function optimally. And many of us are really good at understanding the rationale for why we need to take a nutrient. Like, you know, if you don't get enough protein, you're not going to get enough amino acids. And it's a very simple understanding as to the consequences of that. And, you know, we need vitamins and minerals. The obvious need is there. But with phytochemicals, it's more subtle. So the definition of a vitamin is that if you don't get it, you die, and you die relatively sort of quickly, you know, over a period of years. But we need to view phytochemicals as a vitamin. We need to view phytochemicals as integral to our health, and our modern diet is devoid of phytochemicals. And when we don't get them, we can't maintain the fidelity of our cellular processes, and they start to lose their optimization, and they become a bit dysregulated. So by introducing the appropriate phytochemicals back, we can gently nudge the body back into optimal functional performance. And it's in the metabolic category, those things I just mentioned, they're all foods or food spices. And a significant part of the reason we're here, you know, like in this modern epidemic, is because we've forgotten how to eat properly. So it's our job and I think it's probably impossible, you know, to have, you know, a modern person eating the perfect diet. There's not enough time to cook the food, and there's a lack of knowledge about what to eat, and we've lost our tradition. So it's behovent upon us to supplement people, to you know, get them back into good health. So bitter melon, there's 29 bitter receptors in the body. There's only three receptors for sweet and umami tastes. So bitterness is evolutionarily significant. And these bitter receptors are expressed just about in all of the tissues in our body. You know, you name one and there's bitter receptors there in strange places, like on our immune cells, in the air, the linings of the airways in our lungs, on the mucus linings in our sinuses, in our kidneys, in our thyroid, in our testes, if you're men. So bitter melon has got an ability to interact with bitter receptors in the small intestine, where we retaste the food that we eat again. And when those bitter receptors are activated, it brings about control over appetite and satiety, food cravings, and it facilitates a normalization of the digestive processes, as well as regulation of glucose control and a resolution of insulin resistance. So it's a pretty big deal. And we could simply say, eat bitter melon on a regular basis, you know, for your metabolic syndrome, but people aren't going to do that. So we need to put it in a tablet. Cinnamon at like 1.5 grams a day is significantly beneficial in resolving insulin resistance. There's clinical studies for that. And then nigella, which has been around forever, and in the traditional setting, it was described as the cure for all diseases except death. You know, it's a pretty impressive moniker to have to live up to.
Yeah.
And nigella is a really impressive herb. It's kind of pleiotropic in the way that it works. It acts on lots of pathways, many that are yet still to be discovered. And when you take 2 grams of nigella seed a day, it resolves blood glucose. It resolves elevated blood lipids and low HDL. It can improve BMI. It can reduce blood pressure. So that's a combination of herbs that go really well together. It's easy to apply. And then the final herb that I would use in this constellation of herbs for metabolic syndrome would be a bioavailable form of curcumin from turmeric. And that's probably the most pleiotropic herb that we have access to. And it has the ability to correct more than 1,000 aberrant protein pathways in our body. And it's highly significant in all of the key places in control of stress, control of inflammation, control of metabolism, control of energy status. It's a wonderful herb to use. And if you get the right form of bioavailable curcumin, and in my clinic, my preference is for a form which is enhanced with the soluble fibers of fenugreek. It's a very reliable performer.
Excellent. So they're
my key herbs for metabolic syndrome.
I love it. Yeah, those are some powerful herbs too. I actually started to develop some dysglycemia when I was in naturopathic medical school at Vassar University because they had a vegetarian cafeteria and I didn't do well on a vegetarian diet and still don't. And when I didn't bring my own lunch, I would eat a vegetarian lunch and then eat a lot of carbs to kind of get full with all the vegetables and crash in the afternoon. And then they had an amazing pastry chef that used to be a pastry chef at restaurants in Seattle. And he would put out all these amazing pastries and we would all eat them and then crash again. So it was a recipe for insulin issues and blood glucose crashes. And so I actually used cinnamon and pretty much solely cinnamon and maybe one other item or nutrients, but I literally would just kind of chew on cinnamon sticks throughout the day and that seemed to be enough. So
we all have our personal stories and our journeys. I was diagnosed with insulin resistance at around age 30. I was working in the bakery industry of all things, and it was quite a scare for me. I'd been very healthy up until then, but super stress, late hours, a really bad diet takes its toll. And it took me a couple of years to really deal with all of the appetite stuff and the cravings. But I wasn't a herbalist then, and that was right at the beginning of my herbal career. And without knowing too much, I gravitated towards Korean ginseng. And for me, Korean ginseng, echinacea, and a little bit of licorice on a regular basis with an improved diet corrected that situation, and I've never looked back.
That's awesome. Yeah. Licorice and Korean ginseng.
Sounds yeah, like very, very profound herbs. And it's interesting that if we were to talk about the key herbs for the men's health aspect of the metabolic syndrome category, then the herbs that I rely on regularly and that I get fantastic results with, they're tried and true performers when they're characterized correctly for their phytochemicals. And there's a lot of products that don't live up to the reputation that comes with the label or the brand. And when you delve into the chemistry, you see that the herb's the right species, but it doesn't have the right sort of phytochemical power. It'd be like buying a computer and you're buying one with a certain processing speed, but when you turn it on at home, it's only a tenth of what the specifications recommend. In that scenario, you take it back because it's a big spend. Right. But in a herbal scenario, there's no way of checking the quality. So people may get a benefit through a placebo, or they may just, lose interest because they didn't get any benefit. So these three key herbs are tribulus, particularly the leaf of tribulus from Eastern European countries where it grows naturally. Tribulus is technically, the term is peripatetic, so it grows in all of the continents of the world. And it's got this curious ability of having different chemotypes in each location that it grows. So the tribulus that's a curse in Australia as a weed, because it's got these really spiky seeds that cattle can't walk on. It's got a different chemical profile to the profile from European countries, for example. And the steroidal saponins in tribulus play an important role in improving levels of testosterone, decreasing stress, improving libido, improving vascular function and tone. And then the Korean ginseng that I mentioned, it's profoundly beneficial in men. And there probably isn't anything that Korean ginseng doesn't do from the point of view of the male category. It enhances testosterone. It improves blood flow. It increases nitric oxide. So there's clinical studies to show improved erectile function, improved erectile strength, and those parameters around that improving, fertility parameters, improving mood with long-term use, reducing the incidence of cancers. It's just a fantastic herb. And then there's the ashwagandha, Withania somnifera, which has got impressive evidence in men for improving testosterone, improving DHEA, reducing cortisol, improving semen parameters, similar to what tribulus does. So increasing ejaculate volume, increasing sperm count, reducing abnormal forms. And the benefits are beyond that with ashwagandha. It improves thyroid function. It improves sleep quality. It calms the nerves. It reduces anxiety. So if I was to pick another one, out of the list, just as a general male health thing in this perhaps low T and infertility category, rhodiola stands out as a key herb, which partners very well with either of those three. And the evidence for rhodiola directly in improving these parameters is much less. It's a fantastic herb for improving vitality, for improving mood and setting a scene for optimized stress responses and improved capacity of the systems throughout the body. So it has an impact on the HPA axis, the cardiovascular system, the nervous system, which support the overall health of the male patient in a very synergistic way with those herbs.
I love those herbs. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing to see the change in patients in literally just a week or two, sometimes days, with the herbs you just spoke about.
And yeah, it can be very quick. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen men that have had low testosterone as a result of like in utero exposure to certain, pharmaceuticals or synthetic estrogens, like unwittingly. So their ability to manufacture testosterone is kind of capped at the low end of normal in this particular case that I'm thinking of. And this patient was having testosterone patch therapy as a young adult, and they were dealing with all of the mood swings and the violent behavior and the depression. And their testosterone was getting, their natural testosterone was getting lower. And after just 3 months on a good quality whole food nutrient regime and 400 milligrams of the steroidal saponins from Tribulus, this patient achieved testosterone numbers that they'd never before seen. They were still low, on the normal scale, but because there was, some pathology that wasn't resolvable, this person, was optimizing what they had been given in their lot in life. And all of their symptomatology, all of the emotional stuff, it all went away. And this person went on to live a normal life, unaffected by all of the side effects of the conventional therapy.
Impressive. That's awesome. So yeah. Did they keep taking herbs at lower dosages long-term or?
Once they achieved, some balance, their long-term Tribulus consumption was just 200 milligrams a day. And a good quality tableted product has got about 100 milligrams per tablet.
Okay. And what's the mechanism that we're looking at with Tribulus as far as we know from modern herbal research?
That is a very good question. And the debate is still, or the jury, I guess, is a little bit out on exactly what it does. So the steroidal saponins are believed to have an interaction with androgen receptors. But the more nuanced understanding of that is not like activity or the technical term is agonism, but receptor modification so that the receptor functions better. But there's possible mechanisms in terms of the endothelial lining in the vascular system, which relate to nitric oxide production.
Okay.
And there might be central nervous system mechanisms that relate to the nitric oxide production as well. But in my reading of the research in the endocannabinoid system, I came across an interesting paper the other day that was looking at the behavior of aromatase enzymes in decidual cells of the endometrium, so the endometrial stromal cells. And the paper was showing that aromatase has got a binding pocket in its active site that anandamide, the endocannabinoid I mentioned earlier, is able to bind into. And that moderates the behavior of the aromatase enzyme. And it's one of the mechanisms for controlling the level of estrogen that gets made. And there's an enzyme that breaks that anandamide down. It's called fatty acid amide hydrolase, or FAAH for short. And this is the most important enzyme in our endocannabinoid system because it can break down all of the myriad of endocannabinoid system ligands that we have in our body. And it's not the right place to discuss all of the mechanisms, but it's suffice to say that fatty acid amide hydrolase gets gets upregulated when there's stress in the system. And the upregulation of that fatty acid amide hydrolase decreases anandamide, and the decrease in the anandamide signals to the cellular networks that things need to speed up and become inflammatory because they're in a stressful setting and we need to be kind of on high alert. So in the case of these stromal cells, when you have an increase in fatty acid amide hydrolase and you have low levels of anandamide, there's less anandamide to bind into that binding pocket in the aromatase. So the aromatase makes more estrogen. So you get more estrogen, which then causes more differentiation and more proliferation. The anandamide also controls CB1 signaling. And when the anandamide is reduced, the signal that gets told, or the message that gets told, is to increase the production of aromatase. So you make more aromatase. So I have been curious to think that, you know, perhaps there's a similar mechanism in men where levels of anandamide control those enzymes that, you know, create the conversions from androgens into estrogens. And there's some recent research with BPH and benign prostatic hypertrophy where inflammation is a key player. It's not the only player, but it's a key player. And elevated levels of inflammation that you get in metabolic syndrome, for example, increase the expression of estrogen receptors and the aromatization of peripheral androgens increases the estrogen pool, and it's the interaction of those estrogens at the estrogen alpha receptor, which is expressed in the prostatic tissue, that leads to the development of an enlargement of the prostate. So it's quite an interesting hypothesis that, you know, stress has this impact, and it's one of the ways that we see, you know, variations in the levels of the natural hormones as they're reflected in these disease states.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And one of the things that I see over and over again for my male patients is that they have, you know, metabolic syndrome, like we've been discussing, low testosterone or low normal testosterone, and high estrogen. And most of them, it's from stress or self-medicating their stressful life with alcohol that's high in hops, that's phytoestrogenic. And, you know, maybe there's debate if that's the cause, but typically what I see is it's the stress. So the mechanisms you're talking about make a lot of sense to me as a clinician who keeps looking at these blood tests over and over again over the years. Oh, okay, we have high estrogen, and estradiol, which is the most potent estrogen type.
Yeah.
And then they're wondering, okay, why do I have high estrogen? And the other things that I try to check off the list besides alcohol or, you know, are you drinking a ton of caffeine? Okay, no. Are you, you know, smoking a lot of cannabis? No. Okay, well, you're working 70 hours a week and you have a family at home and you don't have time to exercise or eat well, all the things we've been talking about. And, you know, you're under this chronic stress and you're sleeping less than 6 hours a night. There you go, right?
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense to me, kind of zooming out from the more big picture, looking at a lab test and seeing, okay, testosterone is less than 400 nanograms per deciliter, total testosterone, which is low, normal, and which is, you know, all the time an epidemic. And then they have this estradiol level, you know, 40 to 70, and it should be below 31 or 30. Yeah. So, picograms per deciliter, whole serum blood. So yeah, this makes a lot of sense. So with the, we have the endocannabinoid system, we have aromatase, interfacing with the endocannabinoid system with chronic stress. And that plays into a lot of things you're already speaking about with, you know, traumas in childhood or chronic stress and cortisol and aromatase increasing estrogens.
Yeah. And the final piece in that puzzle that we've just been discussing from a tribulus point of view is that perhaps the And we know this from some earlier research, perhaps these steroidal saponins in the tribulus, you know, part of the benefit that they exert is interacting with estrogen alpha receptors to decrease the effect of the high levels of those estrogens. So the tribulus is working away on multiple levels all at once. So it's increasing testosterone, it's decreasing the tendency of the conversion into estrogens, and it's decreasing the negative effect that the estrogens have while they're in the system, while you're correcting it. And in the low T male, if you just wanted one herb, tribulus is a good one to use. You don't have to have a significantly elaborate protocol if you can improve the diet and remove all of those negative factors that you just rattled off a little while ago.
Right. And then with tribulus, usually you're using tablet or tincture.
And yeah, I do have the tincture, but it's a ghastly taste. And
yeah,
it's a reasonably high dose. So like in a liquid formula, it occupies the majority of the volume. So it's pretty hard to hide away from the taste. So I pretty much exclusively use a tablet in clinic.
Excellent. I did read somewhere, I don't know if the research was on point or not, that they were talking that I don't know if it was speculation or they had done an animal model research. I have to pull it up, back up again, but maybe I'll send it to you and you can let me know what you think. But it said that tribulus was functioning by increasing luteinizing hormone from the anterior pituitary gland to stimulate the testes to make more testosterone. I'm just curious if you've come upon anything that's working on that kind of
endocrinological physiology. That definitely is one of the theories. There's a number of papers that take that line. And then when you do that, you have all of the, you know, enhancements that you want, improved ejaculate volume and sperm count, motility and all that stuff, as well as improving libido.
Excellent. And it does, as you mentioned, you want to make sure the tribulus isn't just from your backyard or, you know, in Australia per se or somewhere else. Make sure it's
I definitely wouldn't be buying it, you know, from a retail store. Of all of the herbal products that are available in the US, I think the number of fraudulent tribulus products on the market is, you know, at the extreme end of the curve. You know, I'm talking really high numbers, you know, like maybe 98%.
Oh boy. So most people aren't even getting tribulus potentially, or just
a lot of the products are tribulus fruit. And, you know, if I gave you a piece of apple to eat, you know, you'd be expecting the fruit. But, you know, if I put the leaf in your hand, you'd be like, what? Like, you don't eat that. You got to eat the other thing. So it's right. The reverse with tribulus. You know, if you get the fruit, it's not what you want. You want the leaf. And in the traditional medicinal systems of India and China, tribulus fruit has a unique role to play, but it's not this role. So many companies buy the fruit extracts and just use that instead. Sometimes they put fruit on the label and they're confident in the knowledge that the average user doesn't know the difference. Or some companies, you know, even mislabel it, sometimes unwittingly, perhaps wittingly, as leaf. So I've seen independent laboratory data on quite a lot of tribulus products, and, you know, it's a minefield. So you need to be coming to see someone like you that's plugged into the quality and understands the, you know, where to go to get the authentic stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we might as well just not take the herb and do the diet and exercise than take the cheap garbage out there.
Yeah, you might get more benefit giving the money to charity.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. It's mind-blowing how much garbage is on the shelves out there in the U.S. and, you know, other...
It's shocking. For someone that's, you know, like, I'm pretty well skilled in the art of this stuff, you know, being in the manufacturing and research and product development end of herbal medicine for many years, I'm just shocked, you know, when I taste, you know, because you can, you know, in many cases you can taste the difference because you know what the phytochemicals taste like and they're just not there. Right. You know, when you have a little chew on someone's tablet.
It's true. Yeah. I think in when I was at Bastyr University, there was a professor, naturopathic doctor, who said that, you know, at least 90% of the stuff on the shelves in the US is just complete crap and that we could just throw it all away and do something else with that money completely.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I'm lucky, relatively lucky, I guess, that I'm living in a country where herbal medicine, you know, is well regulated. And herbs in Australia are regulated as a subclass of drug. And so therefore they fall under the guidance of the equivalent of the American FDA in Australia. It's called the TGA. So all herbal products need to be manufactured according to pharmaceutical GMP. So it's still possible to produce a poor quality product, but there's a greater emphasis on the quality. And there's some really good Australian brands that, you know, honestly and with, you know, wholehearted integrity uphold the grand tradition of Western herbal medicine.
That's excellent. Yeah, I'm very impressed with MediHerb after visiting in Australia. And you know, if there's anybody who's listening who is a current patient, I often get asked, you know, I really like the Ashwagandha Complex tablets, which has Korean ginseng and ashwagandha in them, and skullcap, and I believe licorice root.
A little bit of licorice, and for your tech savvy, you know, patients that are, you know, running on adrenaline and, you know, they've got so much work to do, they just can't stop, they can't see a space to squeeze in even the smallest amount of exercise, that combination of herbs uniquely with the skullcap, the scutal area lateriflora, really allows them to get some control over their lives and improve the health of their nervous system and their stress response at the same time as improving their sexual performance and their their levels of testosterone.
Yeah, I mean, I take it off and on, often, and just, you know, running a business and seeing patients and the hustle and bustle of city life. It's very helpful to just be relaxed, focused, still have energy. I recently had a patient ask me, is there another formula by another company that I could use that might be more affordable? And my answer was no, because of the quality, the potency, you know, the ratio of herb to, you know, extract in the tablet of each different herb in there. And I honestly don't know another formula that has the exact same herbs at similar amounts. So it's, you know, you would have to formulate with all those herbs separately, would probably be more expensive.
I think you're right. Yeah. And again, the, you know, some of the quality issues with ashwagandha, it's, you know, all of the research is on the root at the moment. There's a bit of research emerging on the leaves or the aerial parts. So many of the products on the market, either unwittingly or deliberately diluted with leaf extract. So the phytochemicals that are biologically active, they're very easily measured and they're expressed in different ratios when you look at the root compared to the leaves. So you can run an HPLC and you can immediately tell if a product has got leaf added into it because of the presence of the leaf-specific phytochemicals or an increased number of those leaf-specific phytochemicals.
Yeah, that's fascinating with those machines where we can really look at that phytochemical profile. With ashwagandha, I know it's in the nightshade family. I'm just curious, have you ever seen anybody with autoimmune diseases have a reaction to it? Because I mean, I haven't, but I know that autoimmune conditions sometimes have sensitivities or intolerances to nightshade family.
No, I haven't, and the answer lies in the phytochemistry of the plant and the phytochemistry of the fruit the fruiting bodies that we eat in the nightshade family are expressed differently in the root. So because we're using a root, there's not the same chance for having those reactions because the phytochemicals aren't there that do that. And ashwagandha, it's not a logical first choice in someone with an autoimmune disease, but it has significant immunomodulatory effects. And
right.
In an autoimmune disease, there's effectively an imbalance between the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. There's too much danger present, so the immune system is like under so much threat that it starts to misbehave. And there's a lot of similarity between the bacterial and microbial world in terms of the proteins that are expressed in those other organisms. There's a lot of similarity between that and human tissues. So in a state where you've got this dysregulated environment, when the perfect storm happens, the immune system can be thinking that's dealing with an invading bacteria, for example, but it's in part cross-reacting with some tissues, the tissues in your spine that might lead to ankylosing spondylitis or something. So ashwagandha is an immune modulator, so it will help to calm down the immune system and bring natural balance back into that innate immune compartment. So no fear about nightshades with that ashwagandha root.
That's good to know. Yeah, I just had that kind of burning question because I never seen any reactions, and you make a very key point. You know, botanically, we're using the fruit with bell peppers and tomatoes and eggplant, yeah, etc.
And herb, when you extract herbs with solutions of ethanol in water, which is how it's been done for 400 years in Western herbal medicine, you leave behind any proteins. They don't get extracted. So reactions that patients have, particularly the allergic type reactions, are predominantly associated with the proteins. So the risk of an allergic reaction for a herb in general, when it's made in that way, is quite lessened. So it's a different story if you're making a herbal tea, but with an ethanolic extract, it's a much safer environment.
Yeah, that's typically my favorite way to prescribe herbs if patients are going to be compliant with the herbal tincture extracts, and to make my own tinctures here and there and take them myself just because of how fast acting they are. I'm curious with the herbs you were mentioning specific for men's hormone health: ashwagandha, Korean ginseng, tribulus, and rhodiola. I think I got all four. With those herbs, how much of an improvement have you seen in testosterone in a lab report over how many months, or and how much improvement have you seen with symptoms of low testosterone, like low libido, sexual dysfunction, or low motivation, improvement in mood, and things like that?
In my clinic, I'm not as focused as much on the numbers or the lab tests as I am on the external symptoms that are being expressed. Mm-hmm. So the speed with which the herbs work are dependent on the compliance of the patient, not just to the therapy, but also to the recommendations in terms of lifestyle stuff.
Right.
But a good rule of thumb with tribulus is that you see dramatic improvements in almost everybody within 3 months. And if you were to do a survey of patients at the end of month one, they'd all say, I feel much better. Month two, they all say, I'm starting to feel really great. And by the third month, they're typically saying, I feel fantastic. I want to stay on this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And that you prefer tablet because of the tincture tastes so horrid, as you mentioned.
The limited exposure I've had to looking at testosterone numbers, when you've got some serious pathology going on, anywhere between 3 and 6 months, men can go back to, you know, normal.
Mm-hmm.
Quite effortlessly. And I've seen cases where that's been done just using tribulus, you know, not necessarily combining it with other things. I do believe that you get better, more faster results when you combine a couple of the herbs together.
Right. The formulation. That's excellent. Any parting thoughts or comments that you think men should know about herbal medicine and to be more open to it? Or
I think a good parting comment would be that we have to resist the it's really like brainwashing, you know, that we've experienced in the last 150 years, the constant barrage of media that, you know, herbs aren't effective. You know, if anything, they're only mild in their effect. At worst, they're going to be serious for your health and you should avoid them. You shouldn't combine them with drugs, and it's mostly a waste of money. And if anything, it's going to be a good placebo. I think we have to look at the facts. We have to get back to thinking a bit more about the natural world that we live in, and we're divorced from our natural world, many of us, and our biology needs certain inputs, and those inputs are designed to come from plants. They're not designed to come from some chemical factory with some xenobiotic chemical that the body's never seen or heard of before. And the phytochemistry of the natural world, whether it's at the food end of the spectrum or if it's at the medical kind of end of the spectrum, we all need them on a daily basis. And if we don't get them, we'll become unwell. And then in an unwell setting, the judicious use of medicinal herbs can bring you back into good health. And then you could maintain that health with, you know, some good quality, you know, herbal supplements that give you, you know, what you're lacking. And then depending on the environment that you live in and the stress that you're under, then you could maintain your health with selected medicinal herbs. And people often argue with me that, you know, we're just not meant to take herbs daily. And my response is, well, we need to eat daily. We can't just decide not to eat. We should be exercising regularly. We just can't do it once a week and get the full benefit. So we need to be thinking about taking perhaps some more heavy-duty herbs on a regular basis, because we live in a world now that's incredibly stressful on our bodies. We can't hide away from the polluted air. It's really hard to eat properly. You know, it's hard to avoid a sedentary lifestyle with the work that we do. So relax into the fact that nature has the solutions, and if we get them in their authentic form, they will really genuinely help us and never harm us.
Lovely. I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. That was excellent. Yeah. Use herbs first, folks. Well, thanks so much, Lee.
My pleasure, Sam. Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, it's been excellent. So if people are wondering where you can find Lee Carroll, he has a website, leecarrollherbalist.com, LeeCarrollHerbalist.com. You can find on social media at @herba_meditari and on Facebook at Lee Carroll Herbalist. He also has a online course program in functional herbal therapy at SOWNutritionalSystems.com. So you can check that out. And it was excellent. Again, it was excellent speaking with you. Thanks for your time. I know you're busy and you're traveling around the country speaking to practitioners about herbal medicine and how they can use it with their patients. So thanks.
My pleasure, Sam.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Have a good day.
Now here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.